Hey, everybody. Welcome. We're all here, which is good. If this is the panel on the oil industry's bet on plastic and LNG. So if you think you're like in an advanced trigonometry class or something, you can go elsewhere. I'm really happy to be here with this wonderful panel we have here. And one of the things just keep in mind as we kind of frame this industry, both in the country and around the world. I learned yesterday in my little SEJ tour of the Houston Ship Channel that 75%, three out of every four ships that go through that channel, are loaded with one derivative or other from fossil fuels, either in liquid form, which was pretty interesting to hear. So right here, the oil industry, the frame of this panel, and I've concocted this along with Antonia Juhasz, my colleague, journalistic colleague here, abundant supply of fossils. That's why they call them fossil fuels. And from these fossils come degraded carbon. And degraded carbon, of course, is turned into oil, which is obviously a serious greenhouse contributor. This very same industry, often the very same companies, have been expanding in two different areas, or the two different areas that we're going to talk about today. One is liquefied, which I think some of our panelists can explain in some detail, and the other is plastic. And in order to get plastic from fossil fuels, it is an extremely brutal process of degradation of the molecules to create those plastic resins and nurdles that we have become much too familiar with. So our panelists here, we have four, we're loaded, include two residents of an activist. I'm sorry, four residents. They're all, sorry. They're all Gulf Coast. I'm the one non-Gulf Coast resident, which I guess is why I'm the moderator. four residents of the Gulf Coast, you could say, to limit the expansion of the fossil fuel expansion into these areas. A journalist, Antonia, and I'm going to do a little more full introduction, and someone who's deeply involved in the diplomatic corridors on the national level to try to limit at least one of these products, which has to do with plastic and the plastic treaty. So quickly, I'm going to introduce the panelists. Dan here, third to my right, has just come up here from Brownsville, Texas, south of here, as a senior Gulf Coast campaign representative for Southern Texas. And next to her left, is the gentleman here, Hilton Kelly, Port Arthur, Texas, and surrounding areas, to both inform the public and their citizens in those areas of the health hazards that they face and to try to put some constraints on the industry. And that is Hilton Kelly here. And to my immediate right is my colleague and friend, Antonia Juhasz, who's an author and a killer investigative journalist who's written numerous magazine articles on the fossil fuel industry for Rolling Stone, Nat Geo, The Guardian, and numerous other places. Her latest book is a deep dive into the deepwater oil disaster called Black Tide, which I recommend to you. Fourth is over here, Jane Patton, who's, how many of you, you obviously have some interest in this topic. CIEL is an amazing organization that has filled with some very knowledgeable people who have an international plastic treaty, most recently came back just from Kenya. So I'm going to ask them each to come up and do a brief presentation as to their work on the ground in this field, and then we're going to open it up to discussion. So to start with, let's start with Rebecca. You're being recorded, right? You want to stand up here, or you don't have to, but
whatever you prefer.
Okay, but put your green button on. You have to be recorded.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Yes, it's on.
Hi, my name is Becca Inhosa. My pronouns are she/her. I work with the Sierra Club as a Gulf Coast campaigner. I'm much more than that. I'm also multi-generational from the Rio Grande Valley, and I have many generations in the valley. And for folks that aren't aware of the Rio Grande Valley, we're a community that's on the front lines of U.S.-Mexico border militarization, border wall, like LNG, two proposed LNG export terminals, a proposed oil refinery export facility, and like that whole build-out on our coastline. We're also facing the literal booming private space industry, Elon Musk's SpaceX. And then on top of that, you know, we're on the Gulf Coast and, you know, facing climate change disasters. What first started off as five proposed LNG export terminals, or we also call them fracked gas export terminals, because this is gas that is fracked largely from the Permian Basin and the Eagle Ford Shale in West Texas and South Texas. And now we're down to two. So most recently, we had a huge successful victory last year where one of these terminals projects, just scrapped their project, and it was called Inova LNG. And so, I mentioned I live in Brownsville, Texas. This region is called the Rio Grande Valley. There are multiple communities. There's communities like Port Isabel, South Padre Island, Laguna Vista, Long Island Village, Laguna Heights, of course, Brownsville, and all of these communities have spoken up against this wave of LNG resolutions. They've gone as far as to stop the water district from even giving hints from the school district. Directly impacted residents are doing everything they can to say that they don't want this. The people in power to the gas industry. And so, I mentioned things like stopping tax abatements, resolutions. Our strategy has really been death by a thousand cuts. We've done direct on-the-ground organizing for years, but one of the truly amazing things that we've been doing is like frontline communities connecting with other international frontline communities along what is called the frack cycle. So what that means is like gas overseas, like in Ireland and France, as well as working with French activists who are pressuring banks that are the ones bankrolling these investments. We've had a lot of successes there. Like, we successfully got a bank divest from one of these LNG terminals called Texas LNG. And this is a terminal that plans to bulldoze sacred indigenous lands, sacred indigenous sites that belongs to the Haida Sokomokudo tribe, which are the original people of this region, which we work, I work very directly with and consider them my elders, because they are. And, we've actively been pressuring, other French banks, an Australian bank. I mentioned that we've been working with, activists in France, Ireland. Through those connections, have successfully stopped an import terminal proposed in Ireland that would have taken in some of this toxic gas. And this is because, Irish communities and, just the Texas to Irish connection has been really important. Again, this is death by a thousand cuts in hopes that, all along what's called this frack cycle, pressuring and speaking out any way we can to try to prevent these projects from going forward. And of course, we've also been filing lawsuits, which is like a very common thing a lot of people do. Be active and export gas by 2020, and we're already in 2022 and they haven't built anything. So it's great, and it just goes to show you can't trust the industry timelines. Something that we're really looking forward to doing and doing more of is connecting with communities along the Gulf Coast, in the Rio Grande Valley, connecting, folks in Freeport, the Coastal Bend, folks in the Golden Triangle area, Port Arthur, who are also, fighting their own wave of fossil fuel industry and wave of LNG terminals, because there are like dozens of proposals. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Rebecca. And Hilton.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll go up to the podium.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. And I think it's You got it on green. Keep it there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Hilton Kelly. I'm the founder and director of the Community Empower and Development Association located in Port Arthur, Texas. Our organization was founded on the premise of fighting for environmental justice because there are a large number of people that live on the fence line of refineries and chemical plants and now LNG facilities that are being disproportionately impacted. CEDA was founded in short for Community Empowerment Development, CEDA Inc., C-I-D-A-I-N-C, CEDA Inc. It was founded because, number one, in 2002, because there was a serious need. We have about one out of every five children in our community have issues with respiratory cancer in the city of Port Arthur. And back in 2002, Dr. Marvin Legata headed this survey up, and what we found was that it was a direct correlation between the illnesses that people were displaying in the city of Port Arthur and the types of chemicals they were being pre-exposed to from the oil and gas industries. Port Arthur, Texas, West Side community, predominantly African-American community, can boast one of the largest oil refineries in the Northern Hemisphere. Motiva is today. Next to the Motiva oil refinery, we have Valero. Next to Valero, we have Chevron Chemical. By the way, it's had a huge explosion. Chevron Chemical, we have Oxbow Calcining. Oxbow Calcining is a petroleum coke facility. They take all the leftover gook and further bratchy, and then you're constantly trying to clear, and your system is fighting, and you got mucus that builds up in your throat and in your sinuses. So there's a real, real serious impact that's taking place when this process is going on, which is 24/7 in the city of Port Arthur. For the last 22 years, I have been fighting to reduce emissions, not only in the city of Port Arthur, but all over this country and in other countries as well. This is a long fight. It's not an easy fight. But what I've learned in my battle to help reduce fossil fuels emissions and also to try to bring in clean energy is that I think we have to learn to teach, need to know that there is a better way. One of the gains that we are trying to make is the fact that a large body of people want to know, well, what can I do if I'm not doing oil and gas? So I think if we start to educate more momentum on the effort in getting rid of oil and gas industries altogether and becoming users of more clean energy. But yet, while we continue this fight, people are dying. People are losing their lives. And then there's climate change issues. Let's look at the fact that we know that sea level rise is real, and nowhere is it more visible than the beaches right along Port Arthur heading into Galveston, Texas. I remember back in 1967 when we would go to the beach and the surf set maybe back about 50 yards away from the road. Now the road is completely covered by water on our communities, on our lives. As a matter of fact, in order for them to conduct their business from Galveston to Houston into Port Arthur, which has aided in land erosion. And so now we have climate change with the sea level rise. We have land trend increasing. And what we have to try to take a look at is how can we reverse this trend? Because people are now looking at ways in which they can move further inland. Can you imagine if everyone that lived in the coastal areas from Florida to Texas decided that they needed to move northward? What kind of pressure that would put on communities in those, and look at ways in which we can exist in the coastal areas, turn around the trend of land erosion, reduce emission greenhouse gases, because that's all a part of the climate change issue, other people in other nations, because that's what it's going to take for us to really turn around the climate impact. So with that being said, I'll go ahead and step down. But I
thank you, Hilton. And you know, we're going to you, Hush.
Thank you. All right, great to see you all. Thank you so much for being here. All right, so I want to put this immediately into the context of where we are at in the conversation with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the solutions that are being presented by the Biden administration, which for those, whiplash or multiple personality disorder, where you have on one hand expand production right now and also expand LNG exports. And just to put that all most immediately into context to make sure all of the reporters in the room know this and report on this, there has not been any shortfall in exports or production from Russia of oil or natural gas. There's actually been an increase in exports of natural gas. There is not a supply shortage. There is an expectation of a future supply shortage, which is quite reasonable, but it isn't here now, and it's not the environment. But instead, they're actually a forward-looking problem, and we actually have some time to think about them and plan about our responses, plan out our responses to them. And very long-term production and export decisions that are being made right now are going to have very long-term impacts, and they are also contrary to the policy positions that the Biden administration has told us, and I believe that in Ukraine, one of the things that the Biden administration has said is that it's going to, already has put forward, is permitting new LNG exports from Louisiana and from Texas. So from the Cheniere LNG export facility at Sabine Pass, right on the border between Louisiana and Texas, and the Cheniere facility in Texas. The Sabine Pass, Louisiana one is already the largest LNG export facility in the world. And I'm actually, sort of, excuse me for doing this, sort of jumping right over plastics, which are obviously incredibly important. All right, let me step back and do it. Never mind. Okay, bigger picture first. Fossil fuel industry, tons and tons and tons of production domestically in the United States, needs to do something with the oil, needs to do something with the natural gas. There's a waning market for the oil to be used in transportation. What are they going to do with their product? Plastics, great big solution. Plastics are made from natural gas, but they're also made from oil. So a big chunk of oil is also going to plastics, and it's a future solution. Natural gas, also plastics, a solution. And all of that work that Mark is talking about and how you shift it from the oil or the natural gas and then convert it into a feedstock that is used for plastics, it's taken place down here in the Gulf Coast, in Hilton's community. Becca is fortunate at this point. She lives in a community that doesn't yet have fossil fuel operations, which is have it yet, has told me one of the reasons why they've been so successful in stopping it is because it's a community that doesn't have it yet, and that's when you're usually have the best success is when you're stopping something before it comes. But most of the communities across Louisiana and Texas that have been inundated with already with fossil fuel infrastructure, export infrastructure, are also now housing that plastics infrastructure to convert it into the feedstocks for plastics and increasingly LNG. So when you're covering LNG, and I want you all to cover LNG, that natural gas is a misnomer, right? Natural gas is 90% methane, or 93% methane, and should appropriately be referred to as methane gas. But in the same way that there is a perception that it's natural, which means it's cleaner, in many ways, climate harms due to the burning and venting and use of methane and the use of natural gas. I want you to think about liquefied natural gas. I think also emerges in people's head that these are must also be clean facilities. So I encourage you to go see one. So I drove down to Lake Charles, Louisiana, and I had been covering fossil fuels for 20 years. I'd never seen an LNG facility. And there's two pieces about the Lake Charles story that I think are really important. The first is Lake Charles, in and of itself, is a community that is majority black, is inundated with fossil fuel infrastructure, heavy fossil fuel infrastructure. But if you drive down from Lake Charles towards the coast, it opens up into these beautiful, gorgeous wetlands. And a great deal of the community of Lake Charles, that's where you go to walk. Mammoth infrastructure emerges atop of the wetlands. And this is the just awe-inspiring size and scope of the infrastructure that is needed to convert natural gas from a gas into a liquid. These are mammoth facilities. They have huge flare arrays because you're taking the natural gas, you're converting it into the liquid, you have to burn off a great deal of the methane in process. But it's not just flares. If you're used to me, like you're used to covering fossil fuels or a refinery, right? You've got a flare stack. You've got one flare that needs to be released. And 100 acres, it's getting ready to be 500 acres. Sabine Pass is 1,000 acres atop of the wetlands. Natural storm surge protection for these communities. So if you fall over and over and over again. But the thing that has made it less worse is that they have a wetland buffer. The whole coast has a wetland buffer. The wetland buffer for our coast holds in our soil. It keeps, and the entire LNG infrastructure, and let me just put this into numbers, there's 6 fully functional LNG facilities in the U.S. right now. The industry has plans to increase that to 23, with 17 in the Gulf Coast alone. The new and expanded, that's more than 25 coal-fired. Also, these facilities release the same pollutants, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, VOX, microscopic soot, carbon monoxide. They cause asthma, respiratory disease, heart disease, preterm birth, cancer, as the fossil land on wetlands areas. They're all also predicted to be gone in 50 years, right? We're already facing coastal erosion from these operations, and they're planning to build this infrastructure on top of wetlands that would further destroy the wetlands, that would also further put them in place of washing into the ocean within just a matter of decades. So when we talk about LNG, and I know I've taken up a lot of time, I really encourage you to cover this topic, particularly now because it's been so timely in the response to the war, to the stated important speeches in response to the war, that he wants to remove fossil fuels as a weapon of war. And he said, not just from Putin, from any leader. And you can't remove fossil fuels as a weapon if you expand fossil fuel operations. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Antonia. Jane, why don't you offer
our... I'm also going to speak from the table. I have to admit that it's a little bit of the stories from Becca and Hilton about the fighting that we're undergoing, knowing that I'm probably going to have to abandon my home before I'm done paying its mortgage because I live in New Orleans. And like Becca, I'm a multi-generational Louisianian. Louisiana actually has the highest proportion of people who don't leave the state, like in the country, who live there, or highest or second highest. And I, unfortunately, to my 18-year-old self, am among that number. I grew up in Baton Rouge, which is at one end of the chemical corridor known locally and for good reason as Cancer Alley. I now live in New Orleans, which a lot of folks say is at the other end, but actually that chemical corridor basically extends the Gulf Coast. We've heard at this point, you know, we know about the Cancer Alley chemical corridor along the Mississippi River. We've heard Hilton talk about Port Arthur. We've heard, we've heard Antonia talk about Lake Charles, which is southwest Louisiana. Hilton talked about Port Arthur, which is across the Texas state line. And then Becca's talking about Brownsville. So you're literally running the entirety of the Louisiana-Texas Gulf Coast, and with very small breaks for some really beautiful landscape. It's all chemicals and refining and flares and smells and toxic pollution in the air. And every single one of those facilities got a permit from our state governments in which they disclosed that they were going to be dumping these carcinogens into the air. And both of our state governments let go because a lot of the monitoring is self-reported. And so these are also things that I think is important. So the story that Antonia was telling about LNG, the methane gas build-out driving plastics production, that is actually a story that was revealed in a series of reports done by my organization, the Center for International Environmental Law. The series is called Fuel and Plastics. It came out in 2017. So really, you know, early work on saying, hey, this is a problem, and it's actually not the story that people are used to hearing about plastics. The story that we are used to hearing in both the media and person to person, it's the trash that you see along the highway, everywhere in the world, including here. All of those are important stories. But then we hear stories about bag bans and straw bans and foam bans, also extremely important stories. But that is not what is driving that these industries have overfracked and they have over-drilled, and they need to figure out what to do with their product to make money off of it. And so that is what we are looking at in the plastic space. And I think telling that story and getting out of the consumer space around plastics is extremely important. It's very easy to pick on the consumer. I don't know if you heard people do it multiple times in the panels yesterday. But actually what we need to be doing, and I'm not talking about y'all, I'm talking about the representatives of the United States government. What we need to be doing is really looking at what is driving these markets and what is driving the booms in plastic production. Becca, you talked about how your strategy is death by a thousand cuts, and we absolutely death. So is going to be the final body the treaty can potentially serve, but it's not going to do that by itself. So as some of y'all might know, if you covered this issue, we were in Nairobi at the end of February and beginning of March, negotiating quite intensely. I think we spent 90 hours in 7 days. We are going to negotiate a new treaty on plastics. So we were not negotiating the treaty. We were negotiating how we're going to negotiate the treaty. International diplomacy screen while you're off. That's basically what it's like. Which does not sound fun, right? But what is fun and what is interesting about this work is the fact that it's not just that there are nearly 200 member states, countries around the world that are negotiating this. It's that there is a coalition of over 1,000 civil society organizations, that's NGOs, that's indigenous peoples, that's workers and trade unions, over 1,000 advocate organizations. That are countries, I think, that wrote a treaty, that have said we want a new treaty, that are from their respective countries, I think that represents 115 countries, that are working on their national governments, that are, in many cases, coming to the UN, that are part of these global conversations. And every single one of those organizations has a compelling reason for why they are doing this. One of those it's not just me, it's not just us. Every single one of those advocates, every single one of those organizations comes at this work from a different angle. And all of those are in this, the mandate now, the life cycle of plastics. Now, I'm sure someone in this room is saying, what does that mean? Well, you know what? Countries haven't decided what that means yet. But what that means for us, and you saw yesterday that question was asked of the panel that was talking about oceans yesterday morning. Does this conversation about plastics include production? Are there going to be targets for production reduction? And y'all saw two very different answers to that question. You saw the U.S. government saw the guy from the European Union say, absolutely, we're ensuring that the way we are covering the treaty actually helps define the public narrative around what full life cycle of plastics means. That it includes stories of extraction of the feedstocks, that it includes the manufacture and production, that it includes the use of plastics. Notice I didn't say consumption. And that it includes the waste story and in the ways that we negotiate these policies. Along that supply chain, that full life cycle of plastics, there are some really important parts that are going to be included in the treaty negotiations and that should be part of the public perspective. This came up in extremely important. What is named also needs to be covered and is on some level more relevant to the United States is the role that we're a neutral observer to this. Like several members of my family, brother-in-laws on both sides, my father-in-law, work for the oil and gas company, at the oil and gas industry. I'm not going to name which companies because I would like them to keep their jobs. But it is personally important to me that folks have a path forward out of this industry and out of this work that is still dignified, that is still unionized, that is still protected, that is still a good paying job with which folks can put their kids through college and keep a roof over their heads. That is important and hurting us. We want to be part of the story even as we are trying to deal the final body blow to this industry that has been hurting us for so long. The other important driving policy and the connection between science and policy. The treaty resolution very specifically calls on the best available science, best practices, and indigenous knowledge, traditional environmental knowledge, and puts those on the same footing. And that is important in the way we tell this story as well, because we need to be both uplifting the indigenous communities that have lost land, that have continued to lose land, and even if that land comes back, in what condition? And how are we actually making sure that we are restoring and repairing and remedying the harm that's already been done? to the environment? And also, how are we pushing for returning that land, which is the larger question? But how are we elevating folks who have that expertise to the level of scientific experts in a way that is actually prioritizing traditional knowledge and prioritizing best practices? Very important in the way that we do this work. I just want to end up with, close this out with, like, and she said, oh, you're at SEJ. I got on the elevator at the hotel this morning with someone, and she said, oh, you're at SEJ, you know, what are you here for? And I said, well, I'm speaking on this panel about big oil and LNG. And she says, well, I work for Marathon. We don't have LNG, she says. And I'm thinking, okay. however, Marathon, you are the largest benefiter of the oil and gas and petrochemicals. Marathon Oil receives over $1 million in public, local public money per job created in St. John Parish, Louisiana. They are far and away. This is revealing not just how much the public is harmed by these companies directly in the ways that folks have talked about, but also the ways that they are harmed by these companies in the fundamental deprivation of resources. The fact that when St. John Parish forced Marathon Oil through local organizing to actually put all of its property on the tax rolls, and this, their parish budget almost doubled. A parish that is in this budget almost doubled. Can you imagine what that means to a community? That is amazing. And that's the kind of work and the kind of stories that you need to be telling, is both medical, physical harm and financial harm, so that things like that story in St. John keep happening. And these companies lose their permission to keep building out these things, to keep ruining our wetlands, to keep hurting people. It's not going to happen by accident, because there is not direct language in the treaty resolution that targets production or that targets plastic manufacturing, which means it's going to be the stories that we tell and the way we tell those stories that are actually going to be able to have the impact for us to deal that final body blow to finish.
I'm going to have to pick that up on the marathon. Another state, closer to where I live. I just wanted to ask, I want to open it up to everybody. I'm sure there's a ton of questions, and this has been just been really eye-opening. I do want to have one question that I think we could address to everybody here, which is one of the key points you made, which is this idea of a transition. If this industry, which is enormous here, let's face Louisiana as well as other parts of the country. So the question is, in the talk of a just transition, and I think this applies across the country, really. When you consider that, what are the mechanisms you look for example, ensure the security of your two brothers that are deeply reliant on oil and gas revenues? Rebecca, you're keeping them out at the moment, but you might want to have some thoughts on this. And then, Antonia, I want each of you to think if in fact, the production of these products is reduced, then Jane, just pick that up quickly, and then just we'll pass it on to each of you.
Okay. I think Hilton might have a closer answer to that question in the sense in where you are in the community. I might actually, Hilton, can I pass it to you first?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
Well, I mean, in Port Arthur, Texas, providing the oil and gas was to shut down today. It wouldn't really, when it comes to economics, it would not really have a strong bearing on West Port Arthur itself, because most of the people that live in West Port Arthur do not work at the facility. But we do have to pay Texas, let's say it's maybe 4 o'clock in the morning from Houston, and you come down I-10, you hit 73, and you're going south. Right when you get by the plants, as you're coming in near the plants, what you see is a long line of vehicles coming in from Houston, Baytown, and other areas west of Port Arthur. But most of the people that live in the city of Port Arthur do not work at the facility. There's outside contractors that come in. They're ready when they come to what you call hole watch, fire watch, making sure that some of the workers are safe when they go into some of the tanks to do welding and what have you. Transportation needs. All these cars come in and have to park somewhere. So they park all about the city of Beaumont, and in places in Port Arthur, and there are buses that pick them up and bring them to the plants, because you cannot get all the vehicles that pour into Port Arthur daily basis onto the plant grounds. So we would not really feel the pinch of economic loss. But what?
All right. I know this is a huge question. It's just what kind of mechanism might conceivably be available, then I can move it up.
It is a huge question, and I think I want to start answering the question by saying that the oil and gas industry in Louisiana has already shed 30,000 jobs in the last 10 years. So it's no plan. I think Mark Shelstein just wrote a story the other day covering the IPCC's report on New Orleans and the state of the Gulf Coast, and y'all, it is not good. And I heard the governor speak the day that piece came out and 2 days later, and he didn't even mention it. They don't have a plan. So I will also say, I don't work in the oil and gas industry. I love industry, that question. You know, I heard somebody on a previous panel say their dad, you know, is a welder and works in the oil and gas industry and he doesn't want to weld solar panels. That's great. I don't want to weld solar panels either. So, because I don't know how to weld. But y'all don't want me welding solar panels. But I think it's important that we unionize, all of us, and we need to have collective, democratic institution of workers. I think that's also true of communities. Communities should have some say in what comes next door. I'll close out this comment by saying Louisiana is undergoing this massive plan for but I'm happy to talk about. When we had a conversation with the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources, which is the permitting authority of the oil and gas industry's waste, they said, we're going to test it on EJ Screen, the EPA's tool for whether or not a facility is an environmental justice to the community. And when we asked, if it flies on EJ Screen, what's your plan for relocation? They said, what do you mean? And I said, if it's already in an EJ community, are you going to reevaluate and look at other sites? Staff on the call. Like, that is the level at which it is just a given assumption that these facilities are going to come in wherever the state government and wherever, frankly, the industry wants them to come in with no community input. And that has to change.
Okay, so we should keep these answers short so we can get going to some other questions. You want to pass? Okay, maybe a quick comment, Antonia?
I mean, this is the million-dollar important question for journalists, and that is, basically you need to look at the data. Go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, bring up the data where you're reporting on for how many jobs there are in the fossil fuel industry, and you can move it out. You can look at petrochemicals. You can look at piping. You can look at production, you can look at extraction, and you will see that these numbers are so small. It's really shocking us, and there's two reasons for that. One is they are turning things, making as much as they can not use human labor as much as possible, right? They're trying to reduce human labor as much as possible because it's expensive, but also there's a lack of interest in workers in working in the fossil fuel industry production domestically, and that they don't have the labor to suddenly start production rapidly, and that is true. You also need to challenge and ask questions on direct economic benefits. So just as Hilton has said, the local communities are rarely directly employed within the industry, and primarily that is because you have EJ communities of color and the workers in the facility. And that economic benefit is going somewhere, right? There are workers employed in the fossil fuel industry, and those are important jobs, the ones that are being held, but that money is primarily leaving the community and going with the workers back to their own community. Now, I will say, so you need to challenge them, and also on the GDP to the state that is derived from fossil fuels and the payments going from the state to the industry. You have to investigate all of those channels. Where are the financial benefits going to whom? Then, oh my God, communities that live in the front lines of fossil fuels and the climate crisis have so many solutions to what should be happening in their communities other than fossil fuels. That could fill 10 days worth of panels. But I'll just give a real short one really quickly, which is that what I hear most often is that there is a political barrier at the local and state level, which is also where you'll often see those economic benefits going, right? Why is there a barrier to transition? There's usually a federal help to leapfrog the barrier that they're facing at the state and local political level. And that is, by the way, what is in the Biden administration's, what's it even called now? It was Build Back Better, but one of the primary elements of Build Back Better was exactly that, financial help from the federal government to fund workers
in the transition from fossil fuels into other sectors. And one of the reasons why you need that from the federal government is to leapfrog this local resistance. But of course, there has been one set of resistance to Build Back Better, which is a local political resistance from Joe Manchin. But the solutions are there, Mark, by the way, I mean, really, really led by communities within those most hard-hit areas.
Okay, I just think, obviously, this is an area for much further report. Let's open this up to you, fundamental to this shift. But let's open this up to you.
So, yes, yeah.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Gripkoff. I'm a freelance environmental health and climate reporter. I heard a bit about chemical recycling plants in this area, but yeah, I don't know too much about it. I'm just wondering if that's something you can talk about, how that's kind of factoring into concerns here.
Any thoughts? You said chemical recycling?
Plastics. Yeah. Chemical recycling.
You mean plastic? Plastic.
No, yeah, chemical recycling. That's what you were talking about in our last call.
Well, you know, in our area, where we have a company called Veolia Chemical Incineration Facility, where there are tons and tons of companies out there that are looking for places where they can burn off PCBs. PCBs are used in transformers to help provide electricity. And many times when this material is spent and they stockpile it, like let's say in Mexico or in London, they need some company located in the city of Port Arthur, so they are supposed to be the top-notch industry or company for getting rid of dangerous toxic chemicals like VX, inert gas waste, and PCBs, and other dangerous toxins as well that other states do not want incinerated in their particular area. So it's a very, very dangerous process, and it's highly toxic, and they are emitting dangerous toxins as well as the LNG facilities and the refineries.
Mm-hmm. And just short on that, we are increasingly hearing about chemical recycling in the context of plastics, and I just want to say two quick things. Chemical recycling is for many, many decades, they've been managed under the solid waste laws by the federal government. The plastics industry that has redefined post-use polymers as not solid waste, that is a problem. That means that they are no longer covered under the solid waste management laws of this country in 17 states. There's a question as to whether or not that's federally legal. So I want to say they are doing that in pursuit of a lack of oversight for chemical facilities. If you are breaking down polystyrene into its constituent monomer, you are breaking it into styrene, which is a human carcinogen. And the fact that those facilities are in 17 states, now no longer regulated under solid waste management laws, should be alarming to every person in this room and every person who lives in one of those states. Louisiana is one of those states. I don't know if Texas is. I think it is. I think it's important that we pull back recycling until 2017, 2018. What happened in 2018? China stopped taking our recycling for importation, our plastic waste recycling. That is when the industry has repositioned itself around chemical recycling, around the circular economy, which is just another word for chemical news coverage of the fact that it has failed. And every facility, not a viable business, tried to be built in the last 20 years, has failed. It is not a viable business model. It is not a new technology. Literally, gasification is the technology that was used to light the streets of New York City in the 1880s. This is not new technology. But applying it to plastics is new, and we should not let that happen. Sorry.
Well, and another material that they use to recycle is the petroleum coke that's left over. Once you take the oil content to it, to where you smell this strong, pungent, rotten egg odor. And once they started to process it and cook it and get all the hydrocarbons off of it, they would take this leftover coke, they call that material, and companies like Oxbow Calcine will take it and mix it with gravel and whatnot, and then use it for roads.
Yeah.
They use it for all sorts of applications, but that's another huge issue. That petroleum coke material, when they process it, there are tons of toxins.
Okay, let's thank you. I know Mira has a question, and then we'll go to you.
Thank you. This is a great panel. My name is Mira Subramanian. I'm an independent journalist. I'm wondering if you could talk to this Plastics Treaty shows some glimmer of something hopeful, but can you talk to that information deficit that we have about this entire life cycle? I mean, we're talking about from the production side that you're all addressing, and then the post-consumer side, the waste issue, where it's going, the fact that a lot of it is being illegally disposed now with the breakdown of global recycling patterns. Where do you see the greatest opportunities for journalists to find information or suggestions about where you think the information needs to come from to even, we need a baseline if the treaty is going to work to even know.
Okay. So we're going to keep our answers to the point, and obviously afterwards you can follow up with more detailed info. But
toxic release inventory. Another good place to start would be actually to go straight to the state regulatory agencies. Yep. Here in Texas, you've got TCEQ, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. Now, you may find a little resistance when you first go to the office and say, well, I want to look at the compliance record. By right, they have to give you this information. So if you want to identify exactly what they've been releasing, what's in their stockpile, that's a good place to start as well. And all states have their own state regulatory agency. You just have to understand what name to look for. But Texas is TCEQ.
All right, so there are some good ideas, and obviously you can follow up.
Can I give a quick reporting tip? Just a quick reporting tip. I think on reporting on plastics, I think very few readers understand, and I think part of this is not necessarily journalists are given the opportunity to tell it, fully get to explain that life cycle of where, where is the production coming from? What is the community that lives there? So the initial production, the production of the oil or the natural gas, what happened in the communities where it's being moved? Did a new pipeline have to be built to move it down to the Gulf Coast? Probably. Then once it's in the Gulf Coast, where is it being refined and turned into the next product? Many environmental harms associated with them. Then where is it being picked up and consumed? Right now, there's incredible work being done that we've never able to do before on tracking a barrel of oil from where it's produced to where it ends up, and tanker that question for the same life cycle approach potentially with plastics is something that could use similar technology, similar groups, but they're not being asked to do it right now, and that would be a good question.
You know, I'd just like to say that, you know, I believe that education is key to ending the use of plastics. If we could really show the public exactly where plastics come from, how it's being processed, how it's made, and how it can harm, you know, your family if you put it in the microwave or if you're constantly storing food in it. I see people every day taking plastic bowls, putting it in microwaves. My own family, I argue with them. Hilton, get off of that. That's petroleum. When you heat it in a microwave and those gases are released from that plastic, it's actually going into that spaghetti you're about to eat. So I think education is powerful. And once the public gets it, I believe that you will see a downswing with people actually purchasing plastic materials and doing their best to get away from it. I mean, but let's face it. We could go around this room right now and look at our all around us. And it's in our bloodstream at this moment. But how do we start the trend years old? I remember when plastic bags were introduced, we were like, whatever happened to paper? Mm-hmm. Well, the oil and gas industries got rid of it. Mm-hmm. So if we reverse that trend and bring it back, but then there was the issue with the trees. Let's reduce paper use. So we have to come up with smart ideas on, okay, we want to eliminate plastics. We want to eliminate paper. What can we use? We got to come with answers and solutions to the problem.
Great. And okay, so we have a few more questions. Yes, ma'am? You in the third row, and then you right behind her. Yeah.
I'm Martha Piskowski. I'm with the El Paso Times and funds for the Marathon Refinery. Mm-hmm. How could I come up with that number for the Marathon Refinery in El Paso, which I think could start shifting the conversation just how much for our refinery?
Yeah. Louisiana has an online database for all of its tax exemptions. The program in Louisiana is called the Industrial Tax Exemption Program. You can go on a Louisiana website, I think it's called Fastlane
and download massive Excel data. These government websites, you can either download them for free or you load the Excel spreadsheet and count up the number of jobs that these businesses claim they created, the amount of public money they got, and put one divided by the other, and you have that number.
And how about Texas, which I think is where El Paso is?
It's going to be different in every state, and they're not going to be as large in other states as they are in Louisiana, likely. You're going to have to look uniquely in every non-tax exemption El Paso.
I've actually Googled that.
What do you know?
If anyone has ideas on like databases where I at least could start.
Yeah. I think the Railroad Commission, either the Railroad Commission or the Texas, the Texas State IRS. That kind of thing. Wherever there's any information on tax exemptions.
Or maybe when it got its permit, sometimes in the council hearings, they often have to talk about the subsidies they're getting.
Yeah. Sure, man, how to say that? Yeah.
Yeah, there was a woman right behind Martha, and then we'll go to you.
I
know.
I hope this is not off topic, but I'm just wondering if anyone is tracking the fossil fuel industry's plans to combine, which, as I understand it, is yet another way to protect its strength.
Have you heard of this?
I have not.
We could have a whole two-hour conversation about that.
Well, let's do that at a time.
Yes, is the short answer.
All right, cool.
Hand up in the back.
In the back? Yeah.
Had your hand up? No?
Applied question. When we're talking about plastics, of course we're talking about a growth industry, which is pro-growth primarily. Would you also like to address the question that the concepts like degrowth, for example, or the consumer you can probably frame these questions in a different paradigm to talk about this?
Can I just say, are there any other questions here? Because we are approaching lunch. This is a deeply philosophical question. I don't know, I guess if we all want to, take it, but there's another, 3.5 hour.
Your question, basically the consumer aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's important education, as I stated earlier, to help people to understand exactly how harmful plastics are and exactly what they're using. When you educate the public, sometimes we undermine the fact that our public has a very, very good understanding once you break it down for them. Because plastic began to be used because I think industry thought it would be a good product, and then they educated us on the fact that. So I think if there was a campaign that was initiated that can educate people more on plastics, then I think we'll see a trend where we will start to digress from using plastics as much as possible. So it has to be initiated. Someone out there today may be, willing to initiate a campaign to educate the public a little bit more in depth.
So just quickly, gross domestic product needs to be the way that we measure the way economies grow. That's very fundamental, and particularly when you're talking about fossil fuels, measuring growth as the fundamental component to whether an economy is healthy is based on fossil fuel-based production and consumption, right? So if we instead look at measures of growth that are all economic equality, including a long list of alternative measures that have been put forward, it looks at the necessity that we don't, that it's actually harmful to have economies that are based on these models of growth, and that we can do, not only can we measure, encourage us to use less, and therefore use less fossil fuels and have less of all of these outcomes that we've talked about. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's, sir. And this will be the last question. But.
Sorry, I'm trying to look really quickly. My grandfather was, I asked him, what did he expect the future to have when he was around my age? And I thought, maybe talking about all types of inventions, but the one thing he told me was plastic. He didn't think it'd be so abundant in our lives. And so I think a lot of people around my age, we all know plastic is generally pretty bad for the environment. Question, how do you communicate this to, how do I get my reporting better so that I communicate this to people that they care more to that sucks? Because I know a lot of people my age understand it's a problem. We know, oil isn't very good in a blockade in my opinion.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a great question, and it's a great question to for everybody to address, and use that as your way to make final comments. Each of you take a minute or two and make a final comment, and you can jump off that question.
I'll just jump in and say, so what can we do different? You know, this is what we have to learn to explore. Let's look at other materials that we can use that are not toxic, such as maybe let's go back to paper.
Rebecca, do you want
to? Yeah, I mean, definitely want to support a transition in Ribbon Valley, in Brownsville. We have numerous, like, white for, you know, our low-income community that benefits us directly, so that we don't have, you know, this big fossil fuel build-out. So thinking about, yeah, I mean, what can a good workforce be for our community? Right now, the dominant workforce is actually Border Patrol and border militarization. So, like, where's the transition, you know, for that workforce, fossil fuel industry workforce? When can our community actually have the space to lead and say what we want?
I think it's also important in the way we talk about plastics and the story to get out of this idea of individual consumer choice. I think that... when you walk into a grocery store and you think about the choices that are in front of you, right? I'm a mom. I have a husband who has a weird peanut butter problem. We buy a lot of peanut butter in my house. I mean, it's lovely. Peanut butter is delicious. The peanut butter that's in the glass jar is twice the price of the peanut butter that's in the plastic jar. I am able to make that choice, but a lot of other people are not. And y'all, I'm not always able to make that choice. I work for a nonprofit. So I think it's important that there were choices made by other much wealthier people that decided that a plastic jar of peanut butter would be on the shelf and that it would be half the price. We have to get out of the community of consumer choice, changing the whole system. I recognize that is a very difficult thing to do. But one of the most important things that people do in this world is participate civically. And I don't just mean vote. I mean, submit public comment. I mean, organize. I mean, do with plastics rather than shaming people for making difficult economic choices or expedient choices around the things that are in their homes or in their lives. And I think reinforcing the solutions to collective action, systemic impacts, because that is what got us here. Yeah. And therefore, individual choices are not going to get us out of it.
Well, and also what helped to get us here is the fact that, you know, many of the oil and gas industries have strong lobbyists.
Yes.
I remember when they were, like, let's use that analogy with glass being on our shelves with peanut butter in it versus, well, what happened to the glass jar? How did we get the plastic? Strong lobbyists. So it starts with your senators and your governors, you know, lobbying and taking money under the table to assist with getting those type of products on the shelf. Mm-hmm. So it starts there as well.
And they lobby y'all too. They're here. Lobbying this weekend.
Yeah, and that brings about the regulatory decisions that are permitting essentially the industry to create when it wasn't before. Is the industry creating a market so that it can do something with this excess of product that it has? But I think for stories that speak to the audience that you asked about, which is so important, because there is so much knowledge now of the problem. So I think you will entice readers with solutions and accountability journalism that is a part of it. So solutions journalism that is grounded in those people who are most living the harms of the operations you're reporting on, presenting the solutions, discussing the organizing, discussing the activism, discussing the agency. That brings a reader in to say, wow, I would like to be a part of that. That's into that regulator there. And then the accountability piece, which is, that's all inspiring to your reader, and it also makes your journalism that much more powerful.
Yeah. Great. I can't believe it took us till now to get into the financial and political power of the chemical industry. That's all to all of us to go pursue. Well, we've reached the point. We've just hopefully you got a lot of ideas here from this great panel. Thank you so much.